This is Audible.
Tyndale Audio presents Assassins by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. Narrated by Frank Muller.
Rage. No other word described it. Rayford knew he had much to be thankful for. Neither Irene, his wife of 21 years, nor Amanda, his wife of fewer than 3 months, had to suffer this world any longer. His son Rainey was in heaven, too. Chloe and baby Kenny were healthy. That should be enough. Yet the cliché "consumed" came to life for Rayford. He stormed out of the safe house in the middle of a crisp May Monday morning, eschewing a jacket and glad of it. It wasn't anyone in the safe house who had set him off. Hattie had been her typical self, whining about her immobility while building her strength. "You don't think I'll do it," she had told him as she raced through another set of sit-ups. "You way underestimate me." "I don't doubt you're crazy enough to try." Rayford stumbled along a path near a row of trees that separated a dusty field from the safe house and the piles of what had once been neighboring homes. He stopped and scanned the horizon. Anger was one thing, stupidity another. There was no sense giving away their position just for a moment of fresh air. He saw nothing and no one, but still he stayed close to the trees. This whole area had once been sprawling suburbia. Now it was earthquake rubble, abandoned to the fugitive and the destitute. Rayford had been a fugitive for months. He was fast becoming destitute. The murderous fury threatened to devour him. His rational, scientific mind fought his passion. He knew others, yes, including Hattie, who had as much or more motive. Yet Rayford pleaded with God to appoint him to do the deed. Rayford shook his head and leaned against a tree, letting the bark scratch his back. Where was the aroma of newly mown grass, the sounds of kids playing in the yard? Nothing was as it once was. He closed his eyes and ran over the plan one more time. Steal into the Middle East in disguise, put himself in the right place at the precise time, be God's weapon, the instrument of death. Murder Nikolai Carpathia. David Hasid assigned himself to accompany the global community helicopter that would take delivery of a gross of computers for the potentate's palace. Half the GC personnel in his department were to spend the next weeks ferreting out the location of Tsion Ben Judah's daily cyberspace teaching and Buck Williams's weekly internet magazine. David called Mac McCollum on his secure phone. "This has to look like a mistake." Mac chuckled. "Did you get him to deliver to the wrong airstrip?" "Course. Told him one, paperworked him another." "Fortunato still looking over your shoulder?"
"Always. But neither he nor Nikolai suspects. They love you too, Mac."
"Don't I know it? We've got to ride this train as far as it'll take us."
Rafer didn't dare discuss his feelings with Tsion. The rabbi was busy enough, and Rayford knew what he would say. "God has his plan. Let him carry it out."
But what would be wrong with Rayford's helping? He was willing. If it cost him his life, so what? He'd reunite with loved ones, and more would join him later. Rayford knew it was crazy. Maybe his problem was that he was out of the loop now, away from the action. The fear and tension of flying Carpathia around had been worth it for the proximity it afforded him, and the advantage to the Tribulation Force. The danger in his present role wasn't the same. He was senior flyer of the International Commodity Co-op, the one entity that might keep believers alive when their freedom to trade would vanish. For now, Rayford was just meeting contact, setting up routes, in essence working for his own daughter, Chloe. It wasn't the same. He didn't feel as necessary to the cause. But if he could be the one to kill Carpathia... Who was he kidding? If Carpathia was indeed the Antichrist, and most people except his followers thought he was, he wouldn't stay dead anyway. Nikolai would come out of it more heroic than ever. But the fact that it had to be done anyway seemed to give Rayford something to live for, and likely to die for. His grandson, Kenny Bruce, had stolen his heart, but that very name reminded Rayford of painful losses. The late Ken Ritz had been a good friend. Bruce Barnes had been Rayford's first mentor and had led him to Christ. That was it. That had to be what had produced such hatred, such rage. Rayford knew Carpathia was merely a pawn of Satan, really part of God's plan for the ages. But the man had caused such destruction, fostered such mourning, that Rayford couldn't help but hate him. Rayford didn't want to grow numb to the death and devastation that had become commonplace. He wanted to still feel alive, violated, offended. Things were bad and getting worse. Tsion taught that things were to come to a head at the halfway point of the 7-year tribulation, 4 months from now. And then would come the Great Tribulation. Rayford longed to survive all 7 years, to witness the glorious appearing of Christ to set up his 1,000-year reign on earth. But what were the odds? Tsion taught that at most only a quarter of the population left at the rapture would survive to the end. Rayford tried to pray. Did he think God would answer, give him permission? He knew better. His scheming was just a way to feel alive. And yet it ate at him. Just after dark in New Babylon, David took a call from his routing manager.
"Pilot wants to know if he's to put down at the strip, or at—"
"I told him already. Tell him to do what he's told."
"Sir, the bill of lading says Palace Airstrip, but he thought you told him New Babylon Airport."
David paused, as if angry. "Do you understand what I said?"
"You said airport, but thank you. What's his ETA?"
30 minutes to the airport, 45 to the strip."
David hung up and called Mac. Half an hour later, they were sitting in a chopper on the tarmac of the Palace airstrip. Of course, the computer cargo was not there. David called the airport.
"Tell the pilot where we are."
"Man," Mac said, "you got everybody chasing their tails.
You think I want new computers in front of the world's best techies all looking to find the safe house?"
Mac tuned in the airport frequency and heard the instruction for the cargo pilot to take off. He looked at David.
"To the airport, chopper jockey," David said.
Early afternoon, Buck sat at his computer in the vastly enlarged shelter beneath the safe house. He was worried about Hattie. She seemed to work out every spare moment, madly building tone and endurance. Buck worried she was up to something. She usually was. No one in the house was certain she hadn't already compromised their location with her ill-conceived effort to buy her way to Europe months before. The pressure of close quarters and lots of work, not to mention dread of the future, was Buck's constant companion. He was grateful he could do his own writing, but somehow the only time he and Chloe had to themselves was at the end of the day, when they were barely awake enough to talk. Chloe spent the bulk of her time with baby Kenny, of course. When she wasn't sneaking in a nap to try to regain her own strength, she used her free moments to work via the net with her growing legion of commodity co-op suppliers and distributors. Already, believers were beginning to buy and sell to and from each other, in anticipation of the dark day when they would be banished from normal trade. Buck lay awake one midnight, pleased to hear Chloe's deep, rhythmic breathing and know she was asleep. He was worrying about Rayford. His father-in-law had not been himself lately. He seemed to seethe, short-tempered, and often lost in thought. Buck had asked Sion to probe, but the rabbi said, "Captain Steele eventually comes to me when he wants to reveal something. I do not feel free to pursue private matters with him." Buck had asked Chloe's opinion, but she had begged off. "Buck, Daddy is a traditional, almost old-world father. He'll give me all the unsolicited advice he wishes, but I wouldn't dream of trying to get him to open up to me." "But you see it, don't you?" "Of course. But what do you expect? We're all crazy by now. Is this any way to live? Going nowhere in daylight except to Palwaukee once in a while, having to use aliases and worry constantly about being found out?" Buck's compatriots all had reasons for not confronting Rayford. Buck would have to do it. Oh, joy, he thought. David Hasid sat in the passenger seat of GC Chopper 1, watching with Mac McCollum. The ground crew at New Babylon Airport hooked a thick steel cable from the helicopter to three bundled skids containing 144 computers. The crew chief signaled Mac to begin a slow ascent until the cable was taut. Then he gently lifted off, ostensibly to deliver the cargo to the Global Community Palace. Mac depressed his radio transmitter. "GC Chopper 1 to Palace Tower, over." "This is Tower 1, go." "ETA 3 minutes, over." "Roger, out." Mac turned to David. "But I'm not putting down at the palace, am I?" David smiled and shook his head. From their position, he had a view of the sprawling palace complex. Acres and acres of buildings surrounded the great gleaming castle, what else could he call it, Carpathia had erected in honor of himself. David dug his secure phone from his pocket and punched a speed number. "Corporal A. Christopher," he said, "Director Hasid calling." He covered the phone and told Mac, "Your new cargo chief for the Condor." "Do I know him?" David shook his head. "Yes, Corporal Christopher, is the Condor hold accessible?" "Excellent. Be ready for us." "Well, I can't help that, Corporal. You may feel free to speak with personnel, but my understanding is that you have no say in that." David held the phone away from his face and turned it off. "Hung up on me," he said. Buck had temporarily moved his computer to the kitchen table and was wrapping out a story for The Truth when Rayford returned from his morning walk. "Hey," Buck said. Rayford only nodded and stood at the top of the stairs to the cellar. "What's the plan today, Ray?" "Same as always," Rayford muttered. "We've got to start getting walls up down here, and then we've got to make the shelter invisible, no apparent access. Where's Hattie?"
"Training for a marathon, no doubt. She's going to wind up getting us all killed."
Rayford ignored him. "Where's everybody else?" he said.
"Sion's upstairs, Chloe's on her computer in the living room, Kenny's napping."
"And what's your schedule today, Buck?" Rayford asked sharply. "Magazine or shelter work?"
"You're the boss, Ray. You tell me."
"I could use you downstairs, but suit yourself." Buck rose. Mac delicately lowered the skids onto the pavement at the east side of the hangar that housed the Condor 216. The hangar door was open, the cavernous cargo hold of the Condor also agape. David jumped out before the blade stopped whirring and hurried to unhook the cable from the cargo. Out from the hangar sped a forklift that quickly engaged the first load, smoothly tilted it back, then spun in a circle and shot back into the hangar. By the time Mac joined David, the forklift operator had shut the Condor cargo hold and replaced the forklift in a corner. "Corporal Christopher!" David shouted, and the operator whirled to face him from 100 feet away. "Your office, now!" "Doesn't look too pleased," Mac said as they walked to the glassed-in office within the hangar. "No salute, no response. Gonna be a problem?"
"The corporal is my subordinate. Trust me, Mac, it's under control."
The name on the office door next to Mac's had just been repainted. CCCCC. "What is that?" Mac said.
"Corporal Christopher, Condor Cargo Chief."
"Please," Mac said. He followed David into the corporal's office. David shut the door and sat behind the desk, pointing to a chair for Mac. Footsteps stopped outside the door and the knob turned. David called out, "Surely you'll knock before walking in on your boss, won't you, Corporal?" The door stopped, open an inch. "Shut the door and knock, Corporal," David hollered. The door shut, a little too loudly. Then a long pause. Finally, three loud and deliberate raps on the door. "Enter," David said. Mac's chair scraped as he bolted upright in the presence of a young woman in fatigues. Under her cap showed short, cropped black hair, cut almost like a man's. But she was trim and comely, with large, dark eyes, perfect teeth, and flawless skin. Mac whipped off his cap. "Ma'am?"
"Spare me, Captain," she said, then turned her scowl on David.
"I'm required to knock to enter my own office?"
David had not moved.
"Sit down, Mac," he said.
"When the lady sits down," Mac said.
"I'm not giving her permission to sit," David said. "Captain Mac McCullum, this is Corporal Annie Christopher."
"Annie?"
"Mac." Annie stepped to Mac and shook his hand. "I know who you are, Captain, and your Neanderthal chauvinism is noted. If we're going to work together, you can quit treating me like a little woman."
Mac looked at her, and then at David.
Annie ran a hand through her short hair and moved to the window between the office and the rest of the hangar. She closed the blinds.
"What are you doing?" David said.
"There's no one out there, and I didn't give you permission to—"
"Oh, come now, Director Hasid. Do I need your permission for everything?"
David lifted his feet off the desk and sat upright as Annie approached. "As a matter of fact, you do." He opened his arms, and she sat on his lap.
"How are you, sweetheart?" she said.
"I'm good, hon, but I think Mac's about to have a heart attack."
Mac leaned forward. "You're both brats," he said. "Forgive me, Miss Christopher, if I check your mark."
"Be my guest," she said. "You can bet that's what David and I did the day we met."
Mac ran his thumb across the mark on her forehead. He cupped her face in his hands and kissed her gently atop the head. "You're young enough to be my daughter," he said. "Sister."
Annie moved to another chair.
"And for the record, Captain McCullum, I can't stand working for either of you. Personnel has a standing request from me demanding that I be reassigned. The director of my department is condescending and unbearable, and the captain of the Condor is unbearably sexist."
"But," David said, "I have informed personnel that she is not to be catered to. Annie has caused trouble in every department she served, and it's payback time for her." Buck had never grown used to the privilege of living in the same house as the man whose daily words were like breath to millions around the world. Though Tzion ben Judah was usually within a few dozen steps, when he was too busy or too tired to talk, the others in the household downloaded his messages from the net. The best part about living with him was that he was as excited about the messages as were his audiences. He labored over them all morning and afternoon in preparation for transmitting no later than early evening. All over the world, sympathetic translators converted his words into the languages of their people. Leah Rose, a recent recruit to the Tribulation Force, often helped Tzion with his computer work. Leah had once been a nurse at Arthur Young Memorial Hospital in Palatine. When Tsion came across some startling revelation in his study, Buck often heard him exult and knew he would soon pad out to the top of the stairs. "Listen to this," he would call out, "anyone who can hear me." His knowledge of the biblical languages made his commentary the absolute latest thought on a given passage. Max beeper vibrated. "Fortunato," he said, "terrific." He phoned Fortunato's office. "Mac McCullum returning his call." "Yes, ma'am." "Friday? How many guests?" "No, ma'am. You may tell him there's some sort of snafu about that shipment." "Perhaps when we return from Botswana, yes, ma'am." He turned back to David and Annie. "Going to Africa Friday," he said. "Fortunato's agreed to a face-to-face request by Mwangati Ngumo. Of course, Ngumo thinks he's meeting with Nikolai. Bet Mwangati's wondering when Carpathia's going to make good on his promises." Annie Christopher snorted. Imagine what the potentate must have promised him to get him to give up the secretary generalship. "We'll know Friday," Mac said. "At least I will." Annie looked at Mac. "They let you sit in on these meetings?" she said. Mac glanced at David. "You haven't told her?" "Feel free," David said. "Come with me, Corporal," Mac said. She and David followed him out of the office, across the hangar, and up into the cockpit of the Condor. Once there, Mac explained about the reverse intercom bug. "It lets you hear everything in the cabin?" she asked. Mac nodded. "Lounge, seats, sleeping quarters, lavs, everywhere." "Amazing. I'll sleep a little better knowing you've got Carpathia under surveillance." "At least when he's on board," Mac said. "Actually, Leon Fortunato's more entertaining. There's a piece of work." "You still worried your first officer's onto you?" David asked. "Not anymore," Mac said. "Got him promoted. He's going to be Pompous Maximum's pilot." Annie laughed. "I love it. I got in trouble for forgetting part of his title once. It's His Excellency Pontifex Maximus Peter II, isn't it?" Mac nodded. "You should see the plane he's ordered. Nikolai and Leon are beside themselves. 50% larger than this one. Cost twice as much. Used to belong to a sheik." "They're setting him up," David said, "letting him hang himself." "You bringing in a believer to replace your first officer?" "If I can sneak him past personnel." "Anybody I know?" "Jordanian. Former fighter pilot, Abdullah Smith." David Hasid walked Mac McCullum back to his quarters in the GC Palace residential annex late that night. "There are things I haven't told even Annie," he said. "I knew you had something to tell me, kid. Otherwise you'd be walking her back, wouldn't you?" "We're trying not to be seen together." "So what's up?" Mac said, as they stood in the corridor outside his door. "You know I was on the Palace Anti-Bugging Installation Task Force." "Yeah. How'd you wangle that appointment?" "Just kept telling Leon how important I thought it was to ensure total impregnability. I came in as a starry-eyed idealist, and they still see me that way. So now my job is to monitor the anti-bugging devices in Carpathia and Fortunato's offices, find out if anyone's trying to listen in. Well, I'm staying on top of it. And in the process, I hear anything I want. Any time I want." Mac shook his head. "I wouldn't have minded not knowing that. Man, David, you're sitting on a time bomb." "Don't I know it? But it's untraceable." "Has what you've heard been worth the work?" "It will be to the Tribulation Force, don't you think?" "But how can you transmit it to them without jeopardizing your security, or theirs?" "All that's encrypted, though certainly not to where it takes them forever to get into it. So far, we've been able to communicate by both phone and Carpathia's own cellular solar technology on hidden scrambled bands." "But, David, can't anything transmitted also be intercepted?" David shrugged. "I like to think I can bug anything, but I've tested my own stuff against my tracing power, and unless I drop enough breadcrumbs along the road, I'm powerless too. Random scrambling and channel switching, coordinated with miniaturization and speed that makes fiber optics look like a slow boat. Well, nothing is beyond possible anymore." Rayford was thankful for the well and the generator-run water heater as he stood under the steaming shower in the safe house.
His muscles were finally untying. The inexplicable anger that had sent him marching into the morning air had been building for months. But something about this anger seemed righteous. Was it possible God had planted in his heart this intolerance for injustice for the sole purpose of preparing him to assassinate Carpathia? Or was he deluding himself? Rayford turned the dial to as hot as he could bear it and hung his head beneath the spray. His prayers had become entreaties that God allow him to do the unthinkable. How much was a man supposed to endure? Did he expect to be among the last standing at the glorious appearing? He certainly wouldn't be if he took a shot at Nikolai Carpathia. But he probably wouldn't survive either way. Might as well go out with guns blazing. Rayford stepped out of the shower and looked at himself in the steamed-up mirror, a towel draped over his shoulders. As the vapor dissipated and his face became clearer, he hardly recognized himself. Even a year ago, he had felt all right. Now he looked and felt older than his years. Everyone did now, of course, but Rayford believed he had aged more quickly than most. Rayford realized as he dried his hair that he recognized neither the man in the mirror nor the man inside anymore. He was supposed to be the leader. He knew he was in charge only in the manner of the manager of a baseball team. Tsion was the Babe Ruth, the one who won ball games. But still, Rayford had a vital role, a position of authority. Was he still worthy? Part of him was sure he was not. On the other hand, if he wasn't going bats, and if he really had been chosen of God to have a part in a centuries-old assassination plot, he was someone special after all. Rayford pulled on a robe and stepped out of the bathroom. So I'm either anointed or a megalomaniac. Great. Who's going to let me know? The old Rayford Steele fought to jar himself to his senses, while the rage-filled, righteously indignant, grieving, frustrated, caged member of the Tribulation Force continued to entertain thoughts of grandeur. Or at least, revenge. Mac McCollum moved steadily along on his daily jog as the sun rose orange over the radiant city of New Babylon. He couldn't get over the beauty, and what a privilege it might have been to be there under other circumstances. State-of-the-art, first-class, top drawer, all the clichés came to life when someone considered this gleaming new megalopolis. He could still clip off 6 brisk miles a day. To some that was impressive. To him it was a necessity. He was fighting time, gravity, and a malady of physical attacks that came with mere longevity. That's just how he felt in his job. He should feel fulfilled, but the enemy was his employer. And as a valued, crucial plant for the other side, he should exult in the fact that he knew without doubt he was on the right side, the winning side. But fear precluded any joy. Living on the edge, knowing that the one slip that gave him away would be his last, took all the fun out of the job. With a mile to go, he made the last curve, now with the sun at his back. His last encrypted message to Abdullah Smith had put the Jordanian right into Mac's own boat. Personnel will ask straight out about your loyalty to the global community and the potentate. Remember, you are a frontline warrior. Tell them what they want to hear. Get yourself this job by whatever means you can. I need you, Abdullah. You and Ray and I cooperated in the past. This won't be as fun, but there won't be a dull moment. I'll look forward to once again sharing the cockpit with a respected airman and a brother I can trust. Buck sat next to Chloe on the couch. Tsion sat nearby, as did Leo Rose. Buck prayed hesitantly and not without guilt. Should they not have simply confronted Rayford? Wasn't this akin to spiritually talking behind his back? Rayford hated feeling isolated from the others. With his dream of eliminating Carpathia, he ironically had more in common with Hattie than with anyone. It was his own fault for making them tread carefully around him. But what was going on downstairs at midnight? All of them praying together always encouraged Rayford. But did this constitute a meeting of the Trib Force without him? Should he be offended? Of course, they were free to meet in any combination of brothers and sisters they wished. Rayford tiptoed down so as not to disturb them. Sure enough, they sat on the couch and in chairs in the living room, heads bowed, praying. Everyone but Hattie. Rayford was moved and suddenly wanted to join them. His motive wasn't pure. He wanted to reconcile with them without having to apologize. Inserting himself in a spiritual exercise would speak volumes. He could even pray for forgiveness for his outbursts. He just wanted to agree with them before God to be part of this body, this church. He knew he would feel worthy to lead them again only when he realized that he was not worthy aside from the gift of God. He was the object of the prayer meeting. First one, then another, mentioned his name. They prayed for his strength, for peace, for comfort in his grief. He could have been offended to be, in essence, gossiped about in prayer. But he was ashamed. He had been worse than he had feared. Rayford knelt silently. Eventually, the emotion and fervency of the prayers so humbled him that he pitched forward onto his elbows and wept aloud. Chloe was the first to rush to Rayford. But rather than lift him, she merely knelt with him and embraced him. He felt Buck's tentative hand on his back and wished he could tell his son-in-law that his support meant everything. He was aware of Leah praying for him. Tsion laid his warm hand on Rayford's head and called on God to be everything this man needs you to be during the most difficult season anyone has ever been asked to endure. Rayford found himself sobbing. He felt bathed in the love of God and the support of his family. He had not given up the idea that God might still use him in the comeuppance of Nikolai Carpathia, but that was, at least briefly, less important than his place within the group. They could handle his not always being strong. They would stick with him when he was human and worse. They would support him even when he failed. How could he ever express what that meant to him? When the prayers finally fell silent, Rayford could muster only, "Thank you, God." Tsion hummed a familiar tune. First Chloe, then the others sang. "Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above." The next morning, Rayford awoke to hear footsteps on the stairs, then a knock at his door. It was Chloe. "Hattie's not here. Nor outside, as far as we can see. And, Dad, a lot of her stuff is gone. She took a heavy load." Rayford rose, pulling on his robe. "Check the shed for Ken's car. Make sure Buck's is still in the yard. She couldn't get far on foot. Buck and I can each take a vehicle and start looking for her."
"Dad, we have no idea when she left. If she got someone to pick her up somewhere, you'll never catch her."
They followed footprints to what had once been the street in front of the house. Now it was just a dirt path, strewn with chunks of asphalt and dotted with potholes. She could have headed either direction. Rayford fired up Ken Ritz's Suburban, and Buck threw dirt from all four wheels on his Land Rover. He sent Buck north and headed south. When it became clear Hattie was nowhere in Rayford's vicinity, he called Buck.
"Nothing here either," Buck said. "I've got a bad feeling about this."
"I've got one other idea," Rayford said. "I'll see you back at the house." Rayford called T. Delante at Palwaukee Airport. He said, "T, this is Ray. I was just wondering if Hattie might have used Beauregard Hansen to get somebody to fly her out of there."
"I'll check the log, just a minute."
Rayford heard computer sounds. T came back on the phone.
"I'm scrolling through here, not much traffic last night." "There is a unique entry here. Oversized Quantum, that's like a huge Learjet. Arrived pilot only at 22:30, left 23:30 hours with a fuel top off, no cargo, one unidentified passenger, destination unreported."
"That's all?"
"Well, we've got a column here that asks whether it was paid, charged, or okayed. This one was okayed by BH, that's Bo Hansen."
"How far you figure your escapee's going?"
"I wouldn't put it past her to think she can march into Carpathia's office and personally give him what for."
"Well, there'll be no catching or intercepting that craft, will there?"
"Nope. You're going to have to go round her up yourself or turn some of your contacts on to her over there."
I know. I appreciate it, T. I'll try to get out to the Strip for some co-op business tomorrow.
Mac McCullum had a full morning. After tipping his cap to Annie Christopher as he passed her office in the hangar, he arrived at his own office to three messages. The first was a list generated by Leon Fortunato's secretary, outlining personnel authorized on the flight to Botswana in 3 days. The Supreme Commander, his valet, an assistant, a cook, and two servers would make up the GC contingent. Two aides would accompany President Ngumo of Botswana. Note that the Supreme Commander has decreed that the plane shall be stationary while the Botswanians are aboard. The second document was a note from personnel regarding the application of Abdullah Smith for Condor 216 First Officer. Not only had he been ranked high in every technical aspect, but he had also been judged an outstanding citizen, loyal to the global community. Mac's third missive was from David Hasid. "Important message for you, Captain," it read. "In person, please." Mac and David had learned to appear impersonal and professional in front of staff. David's secretary ushered Mac into David's office. "Captain," David said, shaking his hand. "Director," Mac said, sitting. When the secretary left, David said, "Get this," and turned around his laptop so Mac could read it. The captain squinted at the screen and read Rayford's account of Hattie's disappearance. "Oh, man," he said. He settled back in his chair. "Does he really think—" David held up a finger to stall him. "Let me get rid of this." With a few keystrokes, the heavily encrypted file had been trashed. "That she'll come here? I can't imagine. I understand she's ditzy, but how far does she think she'll get? It's a miracle she survived this long with all the things Carpathia has tried to get rid of her. She shows her face in New Babylon, she's history." Mac nodded. "She's got to be holing up somewhere, waiting to surprise him." "I can't see her getting close." Mac shook his head. "I know. Your people loaded two sets of metal detectors on the 216 last week. Plan is to use them even for dignitaries. Course, that's due to a basic distrust of Pete, too, you know." "I know firsthand. Fortunato's got all 10 kings, excuse me, regional, international subpotentates primed for that snuffing. It's almost like he wants them to do the deed themselves." "How many of them you think are really loyal to Carpathia?" David said. Mac shrugged. "Not more than 7. I know 3 who would usurp given half a chance. Course, Pete would, too." "You think?" Mac sat forward. "I've heard him say it. He rubs Carpathia raw with his brashness, but he pretends to be cooperative. Carpathia makes nice with him all the time, as if they hand-picked each other. I'll tell you what, if Leon doesn't get rid of Matthews soon, he's going to have to answer. It's a directive, clear as if it were on paper." Buck was exhausted beyond measure. Lying next to his damaged but resilient wife, he fought to stay awake and listen to her. He and Chloe had so little time to talk anymore, despite spending most of their days in the same house. She lamented not being as involved as she once had, housebound with the baby, slowed by her injuries from the earthquake. "But no one else could do what you're doing with the co-op, babe," he said. "Imagine the millions who will depend on you for their lives." "But I have needs too, Buck." He draped his arm across her. "Want me to watch Kenny so you can go with your dad to Palwaukee to see T tomorrow? They're talking co-op business." "I'd love that." Chloe said something more. He tried to muster the energy to force his eyes open and finish the conversation. But the more he tried, the more jumbled his thoughts became. Desperate that he was missing an opportunity to be to his wife what she needed him to be, he slipped over the edge of consciousness. Late in the afternoon, in New Babylon, David was urgently ordered to the office of Global Community Supreme Commander Leon Fortunato. Leon's opulent quarters comprised the entire 17th floor of the new palace, only one below His Excellency the Potentate's. As soon as Fortunato's door was shut, before David could even sit in the gargantuan room, Leon started in on him. "I want to know where those computers are, and why they aren't being installed as we speak." David sat. "It's a technical thing, sir. An orienting problem. Positioning renders them inoperative in the palace." Leon glared at him. "Do they need to be replaced?"
That would be the only solution, yes, sir.
Then replace them.
His Excellency is eager that we get a handle on this. He is a pacifist, as you know, but he also knows the only power a man of peace has is information. That's why he monitors those two crazy preachers in Jerusalem. Their day will come. They have admitted as much themselves, and sympathetic as he is to variant views, a small but influential faction has the attention of those rebellious to the New World Order. Would you not agree?
Agree, sir?
Fortunato looked frustrated.
That His Excellency has reason to be concerned about this Ben Judah character and his own former publisher who is spewing anti-GC propaganda. So replace that order, or fix that orientation, or whatever problem, and get people on this!
Buck was grateful to have awakened before Chloe. He kissed her cheek and straightened her blankets. He left a note on the bedside table. Sorry I drifted off. Go with your dad today, I'll cover here. I love you. He padded to the kitchen where Tsion sat alone, shoulders hunched, eating breakfast.
Cameron, if I had known you were coming, I would have fixed something for you.
No need. Gonna get a head start on my writing so I can watch the baby. Cameron poured himself a glass of juice and leaned against the counter.
You were working on your commentary about the second woe, the sixth trumpet judgment.
I still am, Tsion said.
For centuries, scholars believed prophetic literature was figurative, open to endless interpretation. That could not have been what God intended. I believe when the scriptures say the writer saw something in a vision, it is symbolic of something else. But when the writer simply says that certain things happen, I take those literally.
The passage I am working on, where John sees in a vision 200 million horsemen who have the power to slay a third of the remaining population, seems by necessity figurative. I doubt these men and animals will be literal beings, but I believe their impact will be very real nonetheless. They will indeed slay a third of the population.
Buck squinted. When is this judgment supposed to happen?
All we know for sure is that it comes next chronologically, and that it must occur before the midpoint of the tribulation. Unless God himself makes it happen in an instant, it appears it could take several weeks.
The day before, Tsion had transmitted the scriptural passage he would comment on, Revelation 9, verses 15 through 21.
So the four angels, who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year, were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision. Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulphur yellow, and the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. By these three plagues a third of mankind was killed, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone which came out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouths, and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents, having heads, and with them they do harm. But the rest of mankind, who are not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders, or their sorceries, or their sexual immorality, or their thefts.
David returned to his office, conflicted by the fear Leon had engendered and the thrill of having toyed with the man once again. From his laptop, he ordered another gross of the computers, directing that they be delivered to the palace airstrip. No sense drawing further suspicion. He could thwart whatever his experts detected by planting viruses in the equipment or misinterpreting their findings.
Suddenly the TV monitors in his area, all of them, came on. That happened only when GC Brass believed something was on that every employee would want to see. Most of the time it meant that Carpathia or Fortunato was addressing the world.
David spun in his chair to watch the monitor in his office. A GC CNN anchorman was reporting a plane crash.
While neither the plane itself, reportedly a Quantum 0708, nor the pilot or passenger have been sighted, personal belongings have washed ashore in Portugal. Authorities assume it will be just a matter of time before the wreckage and bodies are discovered.
David squinted at the screen, wondering why G.C. Brass thought this newsworthy. Then the internal caption scrawl appeared on the screen. Attention G.C. Palace personnel. Probable victims in this crash are as follows. Pilot Samuel Hansen of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, United States of North America, and Hattie Durham, originally of Des Plaines, Illinois, USNA. Ms. Durham once served His Excellency the Potentate as personal assistant. Condolences to those who knew her. David phoned Mac.
I saw, Mac said. What an obvious fake. Are we supposed to believe Carpathia and Fortunato fell for this?
Surely not, David said. Unless they engineered it. Maybe they found Hattie and had her killed and now they're covering. They'd better come up with wreckage or bodies. David heard the ping that told him he had a new message. I'll get back to you, Mac. Rayford and Chloe sat in T's office at the base of the Palwaukee Tower with T and two men from his house church. Chloe outlined how she planned to link the major players on the co-op network and start testing the system before actual buying and selling got underway. We have to keep it secret from the beginning, she said. Otherwise, we'll be grouped with all other commodities brokers and put under the GC's aegis. When the churchmen were gone, Rayford, Chloe, and T went upstairs to quiz the tower man about the flight the night before.
Sounded southern to me on the radio, though I never saw him, the man said. Bo signed off on the landing and takeoff, and I guess you know it was a quantum.
Can we find out who that's registered to? Rayford said.
Sure can, the man said.
He banged away at his computer keyboard.
Huh, he said, reading. Samuel Hansen out of Baton Rouge. He's got to be related to Bo, doesn't he? Isn't Bo from Louisiana?
Reuniting with Abdullah Smith warmed Mac. In his earliest days, as first officer to Captain Rayford Steele, Mac had met the former fighter pilot from Jordan. Abdullah, thin and dark, with large, expressive features, was as quiet as Mac remembered him. He was also extremely formal in front of others, not giving away that he and Mac were both spiritual brothers and old friends. They did not embrace until they were alone in Mac's office.
"There's someone I want you to meet," Mac said, calling Annie from her office. She knocked and entered, breaking into a smile.
"You must be the infamous Abdullah Smith," she said. "Welcome to the family." Abdullah looked questioningly at Mac.
"Actually, she's the newest member of the family," Mac said. "She's just welcoming you to this chapter of the Tribulation Force."
Abdullah left some of his stuff in his small office behind Mac's. Then two laborers from operations helped take the rest to his new quarters. As he and Abdullah followed the men, Mac said, "Once you get unpacked, you can get your feet wet by plotting our course to Botswana Friday. We're seeing Mwangati and Gumo and Gaborone."
"Oh, pardon me, Captain, but you must not have been there recently. Only helicopters can get in and out of Gaborone. The airport was destroyed in the great earthquake."
"Carpathia's reconstruction program has not reached Botswana?"
"No. But with regional potentate Bindura Rehoboth of the United States of Africa residing in Johannesburg, the new airport there is spectacular."
Mac shook his head. "Wasn't there some sort of controversy between Rehoboth and Ngumo?"
"Oh, yes. When Ngumo was Secretary General of the UN, Rehoboth put tremendous pressure on him to get favors for Africa, particularly Sudan. And when Ngumo was replaced by Carpathia, Rehoboth publicly praised the change."
"And now he's his neighbor."
"And Rehoboth is his king," Abdullah said.
Mac met Abdullah in the hangar to bring him up to speed on the Condor 216. Abdullah was silent inside the plane until they reached the cockpit, and Mac showed him the reverse intercom bug.
"Imagine the methods of our dismemberment if they found out," he said.
At 7:50 in the morning, Mac and Abdullah finished their pre-flight checks and contacted the Palace Tower. Three figures in white aprons ran toward the plane.
"Kitchen staff," Mac said. "Let him in."
Abdullah opened the door and lowered the stairs. The cook, a sweating, middle-aged man with stubby fingers, carried a steaming pan covered with foil.
"Out of the way, out of the way," he said in a Scandinavian accent. "The Supreme Commander wants his breakfast aboard. He's looking forward to Eggs Benedict, and it's Eggs Benedict he'll get."
With the cook, his helpers, Fortunato, and his two aides aboard, Mac taxied out of the hangar and onto the airstrip south of the Global Community Palace. Once airborne, he greeted the passengers over the intercom, informing them of the 4,000-plus-mile flight to Johannesburg. Buck awoke when Chloe shook his arm.
Buck, get up and look out the window. Hurry!
What are we looking for?
The 200 million horsemen!
Buck moved to the window and stood there, his eyes transfixed. There were the horses, huge, monstrous, muscular things, twice the size of any he had ever seen. Their feet were not on the ground, yet they shifted and stepped back and forth, turning, turning. Flames came from their nostrils, and thick yellow smoke billowed. The fire illuminated their majestic wide heads, the heads of lions with enormous canines and flowing manes. The riders were proportioned every bit as large as the animals. They appeared human, but each had to be 10 feet tall and weigh 500 pounds. The horses' tails consisted not of hair, but rather writhing, sinewy serpents with heads twice the size of a man's fist. Each horseman wore a breastplate that, illumined by the flames, shone iridescent yellow, deep navy, and fiery red. Massive biceps and forearms knotted and rippling, the riders seemed to work to keep the animals from stampeding. No sound of reins, saddles, breastplates. And yet the lion horses and their riders were more vivid than anything Buck had ever seen before. Mac asked Abdullah to oversee the controls. I want to see if Leon starts talking strategy. He reached back to be sure the door was locked, slouched in his seat, shut his eyes, and depressed the bug switch. One of Fortunato's aides was trying to impress the boss. It'll be so neat when Ngumo finds out that His Excellency is not here and that Potentate Rehoboth has also been invited. Another aide waded in. What's the point of this trip if you're just going to put Ngumo in his place?
A valid question, Leon said. Naive, but valid.
First, this is not just an insult. It's a stinging insult. Despite our smiles, there will be no doubt in his mind that this is a slap in the face. He will get nothing he asks for and will be told to like it. It could have been done by phone, but I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much. Second, this is an alliance-building mission.
With Rehoboth?
Of course. It is crucial that His Excellency be confident of his regional potentates. A few more accommodations to Bendura Rehoboth and will guarantee his loyalty. There are rumors of insurrection, but we're dead certain of 6 potentates, 90% sure of Rehoboth, and not so sure of the other 3.
Mac was listening intently when Abdullah startled him with a slap across the chest.
I'm sorry, Abdullah shouted, but look, look! Oh, it was there!
What? Mac said. With the sun climbing behind them to the left, the cloudless expanse before them appeared an endless clear blue. Mac saw nothing, and so now, apparently, did Abdullah.
I saw something, Captain. I swear I did.
I don't doubt you. What was it?
You'd doubt me if I told you.
Abdullah's eyes were still wide. He leaned forward and looked in every direction.
Before Mac could blink, horses and riders blotted out the sky. Abdullah jerked the controls, and the plane tilted nearly straight up, pinning Mac to his seat. He heard crashing and banging in the galley and lounge, then Leon crying out. Abdullah over-adjusted, and the plane dipped. He finally brought the craft under control and sat staring straight ahead.
"If you see them again, don't try to avoid them," Mac said, his heart thundering.
"Keep her steady. They're floating around in space. You're not going to hit them."
"My apologies. It was instinct."
"I understand," said Mac, just as someone banged on the cockpit door from the other side. Mac unlatched it, and Leon barged in, disheveled, swearing.
"A little turbulence," Mac said.
"Turbulence? What's with the smoke, the smell? I've got a man down, unconscious. We've got to land. We're going to suffocate."
Mac followed him into the lounge, where one of Leon's aides frantically pumped the chest of the other. The chef screamed from the galley, "We're all going to die!" Leon covered his own mouth with a handkerchief, gagging and coughing.
"Sulfur! Where's that coming from? That's poison, isn't it? Won't it kill us?"
Mac smelled nothing.
He would check the control panel, but the Condor had super-sensitive smoke and fume alarms, none of which had engaged. Mac knew he'd look suspicious if he were not also suffering. He covered his mouth.
"I'll turn up the ventilation system," he said. "Isn't there somewhere we can land?"
"I'll find out," Mac said.
"Hurry!"
He rushed back into the cockpit and locked the door. "What's going on?" Abdullah said.
"Those horses have power up here, even inside a pressurized cabin," Mac said. "Everybody smells sulfur. They're gagging, using oxygen, passing out. Leon wants us to land."
"We should go straight on to Johannesburg," Abdullah said, working with Mac to check every gauge. "What is affecting them is not coming from this plane. They'd be no better off on the ground."
"They could get medical treatment."
"What's our ETA?"
"Several hours."
Mac shook his head. "We're going to have to put down, or Leon is going to find out we're invulnerable." Abdullah pointed to the controls. Mac took over, and Abdullah pulled charts from his flight bag. Buck turned on the television.
"No one has an answer yet to the puzzling rash of fires, outbreaks of smoke, and noxious sulfur-smelling emissions killing thousands all over the globe," a newsman said. "Emergency medical professionals are at a loss. Here's the head of the Global Community Emergency Management Association, Dr. Jürgen Haase."
Haase said, "If this were isolated, we might attribute it to a natural disaster, a rupture of some natural gas source. But it seems random, and clearly the fumes are lethal."
The newsman asked, "Which is more dangerous, the black smoke or the yellow?"
Haase said, "First, we believed the black smoke emanated from the fires, but it appears to be independent. It can be deadly, but the yellow smells of sulfur and has the power to kill instantly."
The reporter said he had just been handed a bulletin, and he sounded terrified. "While there are pockets in which no fire or smoke or sulfur have been reported, in other areas the death count is staggering, now estimated in the hundreds of thousands. His Excellency, Global Community Potentate Nikolai Carpathia, will address the world via radio and television and the Internet inside this half hour."
Abdullah shoved a map under Mac's nose. "We are equidistant from airports that can handle a heavy in both Addis Ababa and Khartoum."
"It's up to Leon," Mac said. "He's the one who wants to land."
Abdullah took over again, and Mac emerged from the cockpit to find Leon.
"What is your plan, Captain?"
Mac told him the options.
"Go to Khartoum. I will contact Potentate Rehoboth in Johannesburg and have him ensure that his people in Sudan extend every courtesy."
Buck sat in front of the TV with Tsion and Chloe, waiting for Rayford and Leah. From countries in daylight came images of fire and billowing smoke, people gagging, gasping, coughing, falling. Panic. Rayford and Leah joined them as Carpathia was being introduced. The stateside Trib Force sat before the TV, watching cosmic history. Tsion stood and paced as Carpathia solemnly looked into the camera. The potentate was at his typically parental best, assuring the horrified masses that the situation will soon be under control. "We have mobilized every resource. Meanwhile, I ask citizens of the global community to report suspicious activity, particularly the manufacture or transport of noxious agents. Sadly, we have reason to believe that this massacre of innocent lives is being perpetrated by religious dissidents, to whom we have extended every courtesy. Though they cross us at every turn, we have defended their right to dissent. Yet they continue to see the global community as an enemy. They feel they have a right to maintain an intolerant, close-minded cult that excludes anyone who disagrees. You have the right to live healthy, peaceful, and free. While I shall remain always a pacifist, I pledge to rid the world of this cult, beginning with the Jerusalem Twosome, who even now express no remorse about the widespread loss of life that has resulted from this attack." Carpathia pushed a button that showed Eli and Moisha holding forth at the Wailing Wall. They spoke in unison in a loud, haunting, echoing tone that carried without amplification far across the Temple Mount. The words flashed across the screen, "Woe to the enemies of the Most High God!
they said. Woe to the cowards who shake their fist at their creator and are now forced to flee his wrath. We beseech you, snakes and vipers, to see even this plague as more than judgment. Yea, it is yet another attempt to reach you by a loving God who has run out of patience. Turn to the God of your fathers while there is still time, for the day will come when time shall be no more. Carpathia came back into view with a condescending smile. The day will come, my friends, when these two shall no longer disseminate their venom. They shall no longer turn water to blood, hold back rain from the clouds, send plagues to the Holy Land and the rest of the globe. The day will yet come when we live as one world, one faith, one family of man, in a utopia of peace and harmony. In the meantime, please accept my deepest personal condolences over the loss of your loved ones. They shall not have died in vain. Continue to trust in the ideals of the global community and in the genius of an all-inclusive universal faith that welcomes the devout of any religion, even that of those who now oppose us. Just 4 months from now, we shall celebrate in the very city where the preachers now taunt and warn us. We shall applaud their demise and revel in a future without plague and disease and suffering and death. Keep the faith and look forward to that day. And until I address you again, thank you for your loyal support of the global community. The ultimate in medical technology was housed in 2 fully equipped ambulances that waited at the end of the primary runway in Khartoum. Mac helped Abdullah open the door and lower the stairs as Leon and an aide staggered out, leaving others dying aboard. Emergency medical technicians, gloved and gas-masked, hurried aboard, lugging metal boxes. The EMTs soon deplaned, then reboarded with gurneys. They emerged with both victims covered head to toe with sheets. Fortunato stood outside an ambulance, tie loose, shirt sweat-drenched. He wiped his brow, breathing heavily. "Precautionary?" he asked the EMT.